From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. There are some times in the course of our history where names become a joke, become part of the popular lore, and we don't really investigate the circumstances behind these names to the extent that we should. The compelling new doc series on Amazon, Lorena, about Lorena Bobbitt, is just one of those things that takes a much deeper dive into that whole phenomenon of Lorena and John Wayne Bobbitt. Its director, Joshua Facing, across from me. Thanks for coming here to do this, first of all. And it really is one of those things that people, as you show in the opening, where she sits down with Steve Harvey, who does basically the same tired jokes we've been hearing about this for the last almost 30 years now.
Thank you for having me, Ellis. It is kind of unbelievable that she, 25 years ago, was on the stand during her trial, having a panic attack, testifying about the way she was raped, beaten, and sodomized. And the takeaway in the aftermath was that this is just this hilarious story about a cut-off penis.
I mean, the second episode really goes into that. I mean, you have so many clips of, and we can forget that the people, she's the subject of ridicule everywhere.
Everywhere.
Even on the news show, she's being made fun of.
It's, to me, one of the most wild things was just watching those man and woman on the street interviews. And there were so many people who, they didn't care what she had to say. They didn't care that she said that she was raped. They didn't care she said she was beaten. They just thought that she should be tried and convicted for what she did to him. There was such a lack of empathy or consideration for anything that might have pushed her to this brink.
What's so fascinating, too, about the doc series is that we think we knew a lot because there was so much coverage, but it must have stunned you how superficial and reductive and repetitive all the coverage was.
You know what's crazy is in episode 4, people will see the cover of Time magazine that was released right around the time of Lorena's trial. And again, in the wake of the facts that she was, beyond a shadow of a doubt, an abused person, it was out there for everybody. And the cover of Time magazine was a pig in a business suit, and the headline was, "Are Men Really That Bad?" And There it is. That is what everybody was putting forth. It was despicable, and it was madness.
What was also so fascinating, too, is that there's a chunk in one of the episodes where we get to hear her story about coming to this country and falling in love with it. And as I was saying to you before, I thought what was so fascinating about that is she really came here and consumed what this country was in the way that people who live here don't, that it's a place, and it's abstract, and the ideal where justice should be served. And she became a real adherent and a zealot for seeking justice. And like I told you, I said to her, I think she became an American hero in that moment.
It's kind of interesting how you almost need to be an outsider sometimes, I feel like, to fully appreciate what you feel a place has to offer. I mean, not related, but sort of related in a surface-level kind of way. I think of Hitchcock. Hitchcock in his films was always showing us these landmarks, and only because he wasn't from America would he show us these landmark locations where that's the last thing an American would ever shoot because they think it's played out.
Sure, nobody would ever go to Mount Rushmore.
Exactly. And I think by the same token, in obviously a far deeper and more human way, Lorena had this idea of what the American dream was, and she was not going to give it up. Where I think that a person who is from here, they would have given it up. They wouldn't have bought into this notion of the beauty and the anything is possible in this place called America notion that somebody who wasn't here from here would.
But part of that so consuming of the dream led to her falling in love with a man in the armed forces. I mean, this guy who looked like he should almost be have stepped off of a coin or something.
It's almost like somebody wrote this story and just hit you with every cliched turn it could have. Get to America, cherry blossoms are in bloom. It's this beautiful pink place she thought of it as. Get a couple of jobs right away. Go out one night with your family, friends, and meet this Marine, meet this handsome, charming Marine. Not only do you meet a handsome, charming Marine, his name is John Wayne. John Wayne Bobbitt. They dance. They are chaperoned on every date for 10 months. Anybody who's from the East Coast will remember a place called Friendly's, where they go for...
Ice cream parlor.
They go for ice cream sundaes. And, I mean, it is as if somebody wrote this pure, cliched love story that this girl was living until she wasn't.
It's interesting, too, because it's for you something that you probably really only heard like sort of stories about as a kid and weren't really as aware. But as you investigate the story, you must have found that, as I've mentioned to you before, your bent as a filmmaker is to look at institutions that don't serve and actually, in their worst terms, can be actually sort of sanctuaries for abuse.
I mean, what I've just found out over the last 10 plus years in making my two doc features, and now this, is just that abuse is everywhere, and it's probably the most common thing that is infesting society that people are afraid to talk about, don't want to talk about. It truly is everywhere. I mean, any street you're on, any building you're in, you can pretty much guarantee at least one in four people have suffered some pretty horrific abuse, be it sexual or physical. And I guess I'm obsessed with telling stories that expose that, because I think that part of what's so upsetting to me, just on a basic human level, is that there just isn't anything in place to respond empathetically to victims of abuse. We have a system that takes abused people who act out from that abused place, and we then abuse them even more. Whether it's the criminal justice system or it's a response on Twitter and social media, there's a brokenness in almost all of us, and we just tend to pile onto each other instead of attempting to help each other. And I like the idea of telling stories that grapple with that.
But also these stories that somehow tie into American myth.
Sure. There's my first documentary, Lost for Life. It's about juveniles who are serving life without parole. Not an advocacy piece. They're all guilty of brutal first-degree murders. And then the question is, do you think they are worthy of redemption? Are they more than the worst thing they've ever done?
Or as we see in the case of Lorraine, is there more to the story? Because so much of this stuff and the way these kids recover, and you show that in the piece, is just about their one thing.
Totally. Everybody focuses on the thing that they did, and nobody asks, well, wait, what happened to this person to drive them to such a violent trajectory? I don't know. I just think if it's juvenile lifers, it's this myth that there is, the evil Damien-like child that is just born with 666, busting out of their skull. You know, not true. That kid was abused. That kid suffered horrific trauma. They never received any care. And so then, yeah, years later, the trauma manifested in such a way that they did something that is beyond heinous. And then in the case of Lorena, did she cut off his penis? Absolutely. Was she beaten and raped by him for 4 years prior to that? Constantly? Absolutely.
It's a treatment. We're talking about the underside of the American myth with my guest, director Josh Raffet, whose terrific documentary series, Lorena, is now on Amazon. What I just found so fascinating, too, is that this piece is really about there have been a lot of changes, but in systematic terms, things really haven't changed that much.
During the recent government shutdown, the Violence Against Women Act, it expired. And that's something that you see starting to be campaigned for in when you're watching the series, and you see it get passed, and you see how hard it was to get it passed, to give victims resources, which should it take that much work to give victims of horrific abuse resources? I mean, the answer is obviously no, but... yeah, we live in a country where it does take a lot of work, and it does take a lot of backroom dealings, and that recently expired during the government shutdown, and I mean, that's a travesty. And so there's a lot of things in the series that you see that in many ways we haven't come that far, even as we're, obviously reckoning with you know, a post-Me Too world, if you will. And I think that it'll probably take another 25 years for us to even see how much progress was made or is being made right now.
And you remind us, too, in the series that this was happening dovetailing with the Anita Hill situation. And the fact is that, you know, the hard questions weren't being asked. And it must have been kind of galling to you to go back and see how much institutionally, both in governmental terms and in media terms, how fixed these stories were.
You know, in terms of Anita Hill, people will see this little clip in episode one, and it's just like Kavanaugh. Here we are, X amount of years later. It's the same damn thing. And essentially the world that this young woman named Lorena was stepping into was one where Anita Hill had the courage to come forward, and she was denied anything resembling justice. The William Kennedy Smith rape trial.
Right.
The victim was denied anything resembling justice. The Tailhook scandal, 80 plus victims denied anything resembling justice.
And people forget that there were two trials, I think. And I don't want to give too much away because I want people to watch it. But I have to ask, and I asked you this before, but I'll ask again, what it was like the first time you sat down with her to talk about this. What were your thoughts?
When I sat down with Lorena the first time, it was in January of 2017. And I was struck by how sort of light her energy was. I guess you have this expectation when somebody has been through the ringer and is part of, you know, one of the most infamous scandals of our time, that they're going to wear and carry the weight of the world on their shoulders and in their faces. But she was the opposite of that. It was disarming, you know, to say the least. It was really wild. And then it went from this sort of this light energy to a person who's leaning in and lowering their voice, but sort of becoming more streamlined and focused as they start to tell you what happened. And there were moments where you could see it all just coming back for her, and then she would slip out of it and just sort of be light and back to her life today, which is a good life.
Because one of the things I was just so struck by is, I guess it's in the second episode during that trial, just to see that look on her face of just being kind of overcome by what's happening as he's on the stand. When she saw that, what do you remember about her as she's watching that?
I remember her telling me that, and what you're referring to is he's lying through his teeth and he's being caught in every lie. And there's evidence and witness testimony that is just, you know, one after the other, like boom, boom, boom. It's this just a crazy fever dream of lies, and he's just being proven to
be
alive.
And it's almost like a bad courtroom drama.
Yes.
Where somebody is being caught in every single lie and keeps going on. And you just, it's so much of a cliche, it becomes surreal.
Completely. And she said that she just thought, oh, of course, that's literally just him being him. That is the man that I lived with for this last 4 years, who did these things to me and then put on this other face for the outside world when we were out and about. She said that she couldn't believe that the whole world was getting to see it now.
Because it's just so fascinating. We should take a break here. I'm talking with the filmmaker Joshua Ruffey about this terrific documentary series that's now on Amazon. This series is Lorena, named after its subject. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Joshua Raffe, the director of the incredible four-part documentary miniseries on Amazon. Lorena, we should talk, too, because I said to you, I thought it's really interesting. It's a movie about two poles, which is somebody who never can see what's going on in front of him as compared to somebody who can see everything going on in front of him. And she can not only see, but can feel it because she's such an empathetic person. And so you're very careful about capturing these two different poles. It's her story, but it's not just totally centered on her.
We give John Wayne Bobbitt, I would say, almost as much screen time as Lorena in this. And I didn't even go in intending to do that.
Yeah?
I knew he needed to be a big part of it. He's a huge part of this story. It's a two-hander, if you will.
Okay.
But what kept happening is it just became so clear as we were editing that he just proved time and time again that she was telling the truth. Any doubt that anybody could have about what she's saying would be erased when he was then juxtaposed alongside her. And I don't know if I've ever really seen two main characters who are just side by side telling you the same story, but so differently. And at first you're not quite sure who's telling you the truth. And then when it starts to veer off into the other direction, my God, it is so clear that one person is lying so pathologically that it veers on the surreal. And it's darkly comical, but it's also infuriating. And you just love seeing him nail himself to the wall.
I told you, there's one shot where he's in his kitchen, he's talking, and in the same shot, there's a set of knives in the case, and you go, what? Does he just not know?
He did that on purpose. So he's obsessed with his scandal, and
he's still, all these years later, still trying to monetize it.
Oh, 100%. And one thing that he said immediately with those knives, because he was showing them off. I mean, before the cameras were even rolling, he called me into the kitchen to show me the set of what he referred to as replica knives of the one that Lorena used. And he said that he wanted to monetize them as a gift for newlyweds, that you would put a knife in a glass box with a little sign that said break in case of emergency. I've never met anybody like this in my entire life. I never will again.
What was your first conversation with him like? Because you've got to get him to do this. And
you ready for this?
Yes.
This is good. I've actually never said this in any interview anywhere.
Okay, good. I like that.
And, of course, I'm going to save it for Mr. Elvis Mitchell. So we get on the phone, and he tells me he's really glad that I reached out because he has new information. The new information is that Lorena didn't cut off his penis, but her uncle did. That she was having an affair with her uncle, and that they had come up with a plan to run away together, and that she let the uncle into the apartment, and that he's the one who cut off his penis. And, I mean, needless to say, for the listeners, that is not true. But this was, for that week, that was his story.
For that week.
And then he maybe brought it up another time or two, but certainly not when we were filming. So needless to say, my first conversation with him was absolutely insane. And I don't know if he was drunk or on pills or what. I don't know, but the guy clearly was out of his mind. And what then started to happen is he would send me text messages of either a photograph of a caricature of a knife-wielding Lorena with him asleep in bed, or he would just, you know, randomly send me an emoji of a cowboy giving me the middle finger. A lot of 4 a.m. texts that come in a flurry of, you know, 14 to 16 messages in a row, all pleading his case and, painting himself as the victim.
We're talking surreal with my guest, Josh Raffe. He's the director of the terrific new Amazon doc series, Lorena. But there are a bunch of other characters, too. I mean, I mentioned it before that incredible prosecutor who... It shocked me that he would go on a camera. Was it tough to get him?
No.
Really?
It wasn't. I think that's one of the great things about...
Tell them who we're talking about.
Yeah, right? So we're talking about Paul Ebert, who...
The legendary Paul Ebert.
He prosecuted the DC sniper. He prosecuted both John Wayne and Lorena.
And talks about it on camera.
Oh, yeah. He says that that prior to the sniper case, he was known as the penis prosecutor. And then he lets us know that, we're allowed to film anything in his office except his penis. Keep in mind, this is a 94-year-old man. And so, I didn't have any intention of asking him to film anything of that nature. But
thank you.
Yeah.
For the viewers.
He's a total character. He's this kind of good old boy country lawyer who still shows up to the office on Saturday with his pickup truck parked outside, double parked outside the courthouse, just putting in work. One of his claims to fame is, I don't remember the number, but a ton of death penalty convictions, and he is extremely proud of that. And he's been the DA over there since, was it 68? I think it's 68. And he's actually finally going to retire.
Yeah, when you told me that, I was shocked because I just thought they were really going to take him out on a shield or something, that he was never going to give up.
I know.
And it's so interesting, too, because like Lorena and John Wayne, the pieces divide between people who can't see more than a foot in front of them and people who see everything. That's what's so incredible about this. This month that struck you as being astonishing that the film basically exists in almost in two camps, doesn't it?
It does. So there were two doctors who did the reattachment surgery. One is named Dr. Berman, and Dr. Berman has remained friends with John Wayne Bobbitt and believes that he's completely innocent. They recently appeared on the Dr. Oz show together and stood on what is literally a 2D penis to illustrate how the surgery went down. And then the other doctor, Elvis is dying laughing right now, just for the record. And then the other doctor is Dr. Sane. And Dr. Sane, he's the urologist from that hospital. A dignified man that looks like a professor at Harvard. He was just in New York Magazine just the other day talking about how the hospital was never paid for the surgery. John Wayne's lawyer, his name's Greg Murphy, he had helped him to file for bankruptcy. And despite Howard Stern raising $190,000 for John Wayne for his medical bills, you see that at the beginning of episode two, the hospital was never paid. And, Dr. Sane, needless to say, not a fan of John Wayne. So... very bizarre. Those two men who did that reattachment surgery have completely different takes on what kind of a human being John Wayne is.
But that gets to what you kind of the thread that runs through your stuff is that there are people who can't not see the truth, and come to some, going back to your first film, these kids who recognize what they did, and are haunted by it, but want to do better. And the system, we just can't see them anything more as those people who did this one thing, and they won't let them forget about it. And is this a conscious thing for you, that you end up finding these people who can see everything that's going on and the people who just can't? Because it's really interesting.
You know what? It's not conscious.
No?
I don't know that it is. I just, for me, I really operate from a visceral place.
Okay.
And so I think I feel what you are describing. But I don't, I don't go in kind of intellectualizing it necessarily. I guess I just, you know what I don't like? I don't like when people can't change their minds. I don't like when people can't say, you know what? I messed up. I screwed up. My bad. You know, I'm going to try and be a better person moving forward in this instance. That drives me crazy when people can't do that. And so that is literally a description of, our institutions here in America, actually, a complete refusal to generally admit wrongdoing, admit that, hey, maybe we're actually not set up in the right way. And so I guess, these stories are sort of microcosms, for that. But again, for me, it just all comes back to a visceral reaction to those types of things.
Well, what's also so great about your films, I wanted to say this to you, and I didn't get a chance to say it before, is that they work really in photographic terms. Also, sort of capturing them as they're talking and either feeling what they're talking about or not feeling. I mean, that too becomes a part of it, because I think so often in documentaries, there's such a fix on trying to get the story that we can lose that real human side of them.
You know what it is? Because I'm a 70s movie geek, character piece, you know, lover slash nerd, you know? It's like, I love, I mean, obviously for me, everything starts and ends with Scorsese, as so many, you know, it's like that for so many people. But then it's like, I love Scarecrow. I love Joe. I love...
Archetypal stories about American myth. I mean, Joe really, I mean, yes. John Wayne Bobbitt could star in Joe.
Oh my God. I mean, John Wayne Bobbitt could be in Taxi Driver. That's my favorite movie of all time, by the way. You know, it's just these people who they look sort of unremarkable, and that's exactly what's remarkable about them.
Yeah, but it's interesting too because there's lots of new stuff in this. I mean, you're basically breaking information, mm-hmm. and what's been shocking to you, just again, how superficial the actual investigation was.
Yeah, I mean, there's a piece in episode 3 that we break where all of a sudden you realize there was like back of the courthouse thriller type stuff going on. I mean, it you would have cast a younger Paul Newman of that era to play Lorena's attorney, Blair Howard. Maybe he had a little Matlock sprinkled in there too. And you know, and Paul Ebert, who people are going to think is, you know, they're going to think this guy is a, you know,
a caricature,
an ice cold caricature of a prosecutor.
Yes,
he is going to surprise you and show you a level of heart and a level of willing to finagle for the sake of morality and let's just call it moral justice that nobody will see coming.
I mean, there's stuff like that in every episode. That again, as somebody who's got the benefit of 20/20 hindsight, it's still. As much as it works as a film piece, and it really does, it also works really as a piece of investigation. And was that something you thought you had to do with this first and foremost? Is it really sort of open up or open our eyes to what happened, all the information that we didn't have?
I mean, my hope is always that we'll find things that we didn't know were there.
But you must have been. But it must have been unbelievable how much stuff you found.
I was floored. Our two researchers, David Holthaus and Katie Ledain, those two were pounding the pavement in and around Virginia while we were shooting, and they were knocking on doors. They were meeting people at gas stations, and they were doing true detective work. And, you know, part of that yielded something in episode 4 that is going to absolutely horrify people and bring home the story of John Wayne Bobbitt in a way that erases any doubt about what Lorena said.
We're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Thank you.
My guest is Joshua Raffet. His terrific doc series on Amazon is Lorena. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Newell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm going to go see if I can dig up some truth. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.